Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Mike Boyle Show. So none of that crappy music this week because Mark's not here. And Mark is not here because it is the Jewish New Year. So happy New Year to all my Jewish friends. Speaking of my Jewish friends, I called my friend Steve Bluestein up because it's the Jewish New Year. And do you know he's got prostate cancer? That poor guy. So anyway, I told him I was going to pray for him. He said he's in a good spot. So they said they caught it early. Dwayne, do you know my friend Steve Bluestein?
He's been on the show. I heard of him.
Four times over the years. Yeah. Very good friend of mine. everybody sent out a nice thought for my friend Steve. Now, I will say he's a nasty little fucker when he wants to be, but he's my friend. And so, I hope he does well. He says they caught it. He does need surgery, which none of us like to think about getting operated on down there. So, let's pray for the guy, okay? But they caught it early, okay? So that's, it's a bummer on the Jewish, the Jewish New Year, right? So, So tonight we have a special guest host, my little brother from another mother, my man, Dwayne Williams. Hey, Dwayne.
All right. What's up, Mike Boyle? Here with you, holding it down.
Let me tell you why I love Dwayne. I'm going to tell you, besides Dwayne, he's a very talented comedian, tearing it up in New York City. But he called me up to see how he was doing after the earthquake, God forbid, after the hurricane last week. And I said, let me tell you what it's like, Dwayne. It's like there's tons of black dudes running through your neighborhood, and all you could do is hold your breath and hope it all turns out all right. And he just laughed like that. Dude, you're all right. Now, we're all back to normal, kind of, where I live. I mean, a lot of people got hit a lot worse. And, and let me tell you, Rotten Apple, the cartoon that we have going on YouTube, which is doing really well. So I want to thank everybody who's been reading. I guess you don't read a cartoon. Everybody who's been watching them. I guess there's over 500,000 views on these things so far. So thank you, everybody that's out there looking at them. And my friend Paul Block, famous Hollywood producer, he watched the first couple when they came out and called me up and scolded me. I'm like, dude, what do you think? I have an $80 million budget. I mean, the first couple he watched, he's like, oh, the production. I should shut the fuck up. They look pretty good to me. But he watched a few more. I guess we have about 12 on there now. I think there's 11 or 12. And he watched a few more, and he's like, you know what? I think you have this microcosm going on of what's going on in America right now. I go, yes, that's what I designed it to be. And he's like, and I like that it's topical to what's going on today, and it's kind of funny. I go, ding, 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 ding. So thank you, Paul, for that positive feedback finally. So I love Paul Block. He's my friend, and he could criticize me if he wants. That's the thing when you put things out there to entertain people, not everybody's going to love everything you do. And I love Paul, and I love everything he's got to say. But, so even Paul's into it now. So thank you, Paul. So everybody get out there and watch Rotten Apple on YouTube. I need the views. I need the views. Go to Rotten Apple Cartoon on YouTube. And Marco is he was going to listen to the show. You know, he can't do things. He can't get on the show. He can't work. That's the thing. He's super Jew. But evidently he did so much in the last day or two that he passed out. So feel free to talk about him what you want, Dwayne. You could call him whatever names you like. Yeah. I don't know. Do you like Jews, Dwayne? Are you anti-Semitic or what?
Well, to tell you, we built the pyramid.
All right. Let me tell you. Tonight's guest, everybody, is we're very lucky to have Dylan Brody on tonight. And Dylan Brody is an exceptionally brilliant guy. I mean, I watched some of his stuff today. I think you're going to be dazzled by this man's intelligence. He's a very funny guy. Extremely, yeah. extremely intelligent. He's a playwright and author. I think you guys
are exceptional.
And I think you guys are going to be very excited to hear from this guy. He wrote the Modern Depression Guidebook, Laughs Last, another book, a few other books, but they're all available on Amazon, dylanbrody.com. We're going to be talking to him in a few minutes, and I'm really excited. I'm not going to keep him holding too long, but I just wanted to say hello to everybody. And Dwayne, after Dylan goes, you and I will talk a little bit about what's going on in New York. I know you're working with Gladys Simon, the queen of comedy up there, my little munchkin angel. I love her so much. I know it was just her birthday the other day. I got to talk to her on her birthday.
She's 18? She just turned 19 years old?
No. She told me she's 39, and she's going to be 39 from now on. And I said, 39? I'm shocked. Because when I got in your pants, I thought you were younger than that. But all right, whatever. But she's adorable. And,
I love her.
Yeah, she's a very sweet woman. A lot of people love Gladys. She is what she is, you know what I mean? The queen of New York comedy. So we all love Gladys. Next week, guys, I want you all guys all to know that Al Martin, very gracious to come on the show. Al Martin is the owner of, you guys, this is kind of awesome for me, right? A very nice guy. Al was the first guy to pass me in a big club in New York. And, you know, people say, who cares? You were passed. But it meant a lot to me when I was in New York. So Al owns the Broadway Comedy Club. It was just named one of the top five clubs in New York City. He also owns the Greenwich Village Comedy Club. And he's a very nice guy. And so it's very cool that he's going to come on and talk about the comedy scene in New York City. He's a very good guy. So he'll be on next week's show. So I'm excited about that. But let's not leave Dylan waiting too much longer. He's out on the West Coast, and you know those guys are very cool, but we don't want to keep them waiting too much longer. So I'm going to bring Dylan on now and say hello. Okay, hold on 1 second, Dwayne.
Okay.
Dylan,
you can keep me waiting as long as you like. You can just keep talking about Gladys Simon, Broadway Comedy Club, a club where I have not been passed.
I'm sure you'd be passed instantly, Dylan. But you're out on the West Coast. You're doing your thing.
True. It's true. I'm in the place where we keep the ocean on the wrong side.
Yeah. How are you, brother?
There has never been a better time to be in the Dylan Brody business. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. You know, it's so good to have you. I was watching some of your stuff. Now, let me ask you, are you, in fact, genius? Because, I mean, I saw some of your stuff. I mean, you're an extremely intelligent guy. And, you know, I mean, I'm dealing with a genius in my own family right now. My son's a genius. And,
congratulations.
No. And I will tell you, no sense of humor whatsoever in the boy. But, you know, just nasty little bastard. But, you know, you, in fact, have a sense of humor. So
it may be that he's very funny and you're just not smart enough to get him.
You know what? I think that might be the case, but he is just the rudest kid. He gets in the car. He goes to a private school about 30 minutes from his home. So I have to drive him home every day. And he thank God he's in his senior year now. So it's one more year of this torture. I mean, I do it gladly. And he works very hard. So it's my joy to help him. But he didn't even want to get a learner's permit. He has no interest in driving a car. But he works very hard, so he usually leaves school around 7 o'clock at night, and I drive him home. He gets in the car, he calls me Troglodyte. I mean, that's his pet name. I mean, just the kid's just vicious toward me. And, you know, he's just rude and arrogant. I tell him all the time, I go, Brandon, you might be the next Einstein. I mean, that might very well be true. I mean, he knows stuff. I have no idea why he knows it, how he knows it, what he needs to know for. But I said, you know, you need to get there first, Bran. I mean, you know, like, who's going to put up with your attitude? But he's just rotten to the core. So do you think that you being as bright as you are and having a sense of humor, and now other people with your intelligence, do you see them as being funny, or are you just an anomaly?
Well, I think most people who are funny are bright. I don't know that everybody is running in the genius spectrum. I don't know that I'm running in the genius spectrum, though I suspect I probably am. I certainly know that I'm highly literate and constantly learning more stuff and further exploring. And that's as much an active thing as it is the passive of the IQ. Always the job of a comic, and I was a regular road comic for years before I reinvented myself as a humorist and storyteller. But the job of the comic is always to be the smartest guy in the room. And to some degree, you know, you're aided by the fact that you've had time to prepare the material, and the audience does not have time to prepare for it. But really, it's when you're constantly doing the task, taking care of the simple task of taking a room full of people by surprise with the same trick every 15 seconds, you've got to be just a little bit smarter than the average in the room. Yes. So I think all comics tend to be smarter than average. It's part of it's a job requirement. And there are some that obviously that aren't. There are some who are, you know, prop comics or puppeteers or whatever, who find some other way in that doesn't involve any real insight or any particular skill with language. But for the most part, we're smart people, the funny ones. And then there, you know, as with any group, whether it is level of intellect or race or sexual orientation, there's going to be a spectrum as to how funny people are. I have met some humorless gay men before, and I've met some very funny gay men before, and I have met a great many humorless lesbians and a few very funny lesbians. So you just don't know.
I hear you. No, I really was struck by your obvious intelligence. I mean, I started to watch some of your stuff, and I said, wow, this man is brilliant. And, of course, looking at some of your books and obviously being able to sit, and I think, how many books did you write? I know you have a couple big ones, but you wrote five books. How many did you write?
Well, I've written more than have been published at this point. I'm constantly looking for a home for others. I'm working on a new one, and then I've ghostwritten. So I can't give you an exact number on that. I will say this on the question of my own intelligence as you perceive it in my work. When I was doing straight-ahead comedy, I tried to downplay my intellect. I did a slightly blue-collar accent when I was on stage. I cursed a lot. I did a lot to sort of dumb myself down just a little bit so that no matter how intellectual the ideas were that I was expressing, I was a little bit more accessible to an audience, felt a little bit more streetwise and less learned. It was when I reinvented myself and when I quit smoking pot and had been out of stand-up on the road for a while that I went, okay, I'm not going to be stupider than I am anymore. Will Durst once saw me after a show. He fixed a joke. He saw a joke I had done, and it wasn't working. And he said, for that joke to work, they have to believe that you're stupid enough to make that mistake. Never play stupider than you are. Your own stupidity is enough to cover the job. And it fixed that joke. And then it took a long time for me to realize that there were all these other ways that I was doing it. And now I just make sure that I am always playing to the top of my game. It's not that I'm putting my intellect on display, and I am, but that's a byproduct of the fact that I am just not willing to appear stupider than I am. And in the books, it's the same thing. I learn more and more that the more simply I write, the more brilliant people think I am. The more I limit myself to just what needs to be said to get the point across, the more people think I'm saying so much with so few words. And I love writing. I'm constantly writing. So it's not, there's the Modern Depression Guidebook and Laughs Last are the two that are in print right now for grown-ups that I love. And the Modern Depression Guidebook is a very small, very light read. It's a tiny little humor book. It's a mock self-help book. Laughs Last is a novel. Then there are two earlier ones that were out for the young adult market that are still on the market. A Tale of a Hero and The Song of Her Sword, which is used, at least it was used for many years, in the curriculum in some grade school in, I want to say South Carolina. I'm not sure that's right. But a teacher would do a thing. It's for gifted kids, this book. And there was a teacher who would do a thing where all the kids could choose from, I don't know, three or five books, and they would read the book, whichever one they had chosen, and then they had to write letters to the author. And for the first, I don't know, 7 years that that book was out on the market, every year I got a bunch of letters from these grade schoolers with a question. Mm. Each one would have a question for me, and I would diligently write back to all of them, thinking that that made me a good guy. And then it didn't happen 1 year, and then the next year they started coming in by email, and I kept writing back to them. But that hasn't happened in a few years, so I'm guessing just nobody chose my book 2 years in a row and she took it off the roster. And then The Warm Hello was a science fiction novel that came out from that same company. And then the only other one is a novella that's no longer in print, the only other one that's been published. It was called Heroes Fall. And I keep thinking about doing something with that one again, but then I don't because I'm too busy making stuff to actually put stuff out into the world.
Well, that's just that's a prolific amount of work. I mean, you know, to think about writing that much, and I mean, it's a lot of writing. And not me really think about. I mean, I write. I mean, I do a 3 minute cartoon every day now.
Well done.
Yeah, 3 minutes, dude. And you know, and you think like it's 3 minutes, and when I accepted the job to do this, and you think 3 minutes is like, think about it, it's 3 minutes. You know how long it takes to type out 3 minutes? Like I type it
probably
out.
Probably longer for you than it does for me.
Yeah, well, yeah, and but still, 3 minutes. I type it out in screenplay format so that the people who animate it know what's going on. So I have to put a little bit more than exactly what's being said. I have to describe where they're sitting and that kind of stuff. But still, it takes like, you know, a little bit of time. So I can imagine sitting there writing an entire novel and that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's a lot of work to produce. I mean, plus you go ahead.
I do write very quickly. I make no mistake. It's the thing I enjoy doing most, and it is not that much effort for me. I'm currently working on a collection of short stories that I believe I have a new agent, and he liked an idea that I had going in three short stories. He said, can you write more of these? I said, yeah. So I've been building the next book on these short stories, and when I am at my desk, I can write one in an evening. Right, they run 5 to 14 pages, and one of them, I think the longest one is 22 pages or something. And each one takes me a couple of hours to write, and then I'm done. When I'm writing a screenplay, I will write 16 or 18 hours a day, but I'll write a screenplay in a week, sometimes less. When I was writing for, I was recently writing for Peking Duckling, a preschooler's animated series from Little Airplane Productions. 2 years ago, I guess, and those are 12-minute episodes, and they would take me an hour to write each one. So I know that I write very quickly, and that's part of why I'm so prolific. But it also has to do with simply having done it as much as I have over the years, I trust my impulse. So there's not a lot of second-guessing that goes on. Frequently, an idea that occurs to me in the car on the way home from something will be a complete piece on the page by the time it's done.
Well, that's awesome. I have to tell
you guys.
I have to tell you guys that you really need, I mean, I know there's so much going on in the world right now, and there's so many places you can look for things, but if you really want to check out somebody that's intelligent and funny, and we're going to keep talking to Dylan for a little bit, but I want to get this out there. You need to go to dylanbrody.com. I'm going to spell it. It's DylanBrody.com. And you can check out what he's got over there. And you can get his book, The Modern Depression Guidebook and Laughs Last, on his site, or you can go to Amazon and get them. But also, You guys can check him out on Facebook, Dylan Brody. But I'll tell you, you know, doing what I do for, you know, what I do, talking to somebody every week like this in this format and being friends with so many different comedians and other type of artists. I'm friends with models. I'm friends with dancers. I'm friends with actors. It's a very cool thing to talk to artists every week, and it's very cool, and I love it, and I love talking to people who get to communicate with people. But the thing is that, you know, sometimes you lose a little bit of the excitement that you get, but because, you know, you talk to people so much, or you go to comedy clubs and you see so many comedians, sometimes it's hard to laugh. So when I see somebody that I could go, wow, this guy's intelligent, I want to see more, it excites me. So I am very excited by my new friend Dylan Brody. I want you guys to check him out too. So you definitely have to check him out. DylanBrody.com. No,
Paul
for sure.
Paul Provenza told me that I treat comedy as literature, and I love that. I love the idea that that's how it comes across, because I do. I've always thought of stand-up comedy as an art. Not everybody does. And I have always thought of comedy and humor and literature and television and film as ways of communicating as opposed to ways of making money. And I think the best artists are the ones who have something to say as opposed to the ones who are trying to get something.
I think you and I definitely have that in common, because stand-up definitely is an art. I believe that 100%. And I remember I said that in a club one night, and there was a bunch of young comics, and they all laughed at me because I said, this is my art. And they laughed right in my face. And I said, people, you don't even know what you're talking about. But art, I mean, from the time cavemen went in a cave and drew something on a wall, I mean, it's all the same thing. It's so that you can look at it and communicate an idea, and, you know, it's to get people to think of something else for a minute. And so whether music, or whether it's you're reading something, or whether you're looking at a painting, it's to take your mind somewhere else and get your mind out of your shit. And I think comedy is a very high art, because people don't even realize when they're laughing for a few minutes how awesome that is for your body. I mean, it just does so many wonderful things for you. So I think comedians and people who can really get you to laugh are doing just like such a wonderful thing for people. So, I believe.
I would take issue with some of that, because here's the thing. Because of the nature of capitalism, we don't have an arts industry. We have an entertainment industry. And I believe that entertainment is the word people use when they don't want to take responsibility for what they say through their art. Artists are paying attention to what they're saying and doing it for the sake of communication. Entertainers are doing it to make a living and or just to make people laugh, because that's so nice when you can escape your reality for a minute. Television is entertainment. I don't think of it as art. And certainly, you know, the endlessly repetitive hour-long cop dramas in which we are told over and over again that that police are always the good guys, that they will always catch the bad guys, that the bad guys will always be punished, that anyone who is perceived as irredeemable but wants to be better will be killed by the end of the episode. I mean, the formula is so strict that it's really just repetition of the same pro-status quo morality plays over and over again, and situation comedies in which they tell us over and over again that the best thing that could possibly happen is that at the end of any conflict, things are exactly the way they were before they started. I think this is very dangerous, and I don't think it's art. And there are a lot of comics who think of themselves not as artists but as entertainers, and think of it not as an art, but as a craft. And some of them are very, very successful.
That's true.
And they're very palatable. They don't offend anybody. They don't risk anything. And some of them are terrific at what they do. But they're not thinking of it as, or treating it as, an art. And those of us who do treat it as art and think of it as our art sometimes have a more difficult time making a living with it, because it becomes then this internal struggle. What I am doing is for good, not for a living, and what am I if I allow myself to sell it, and how am I devaluing it if I try to get its worth, and so on. It becomes even more complex to just talk to club owners, because it all becomes so personal and so important and so precious when we're trying to get booked, that every rejection becomes a rejection of our very raison d'être, if you don't mind me speaking through my phlegm for a moment. Whereas the entertainer, who just thinks of it as a product that they're out to sell, doesn't have problems with the numbers game of getting rejected 10 times to get one gig, because it's not their soul that they're putting on the line. And this is why, you know, I have to produce 20 times as much every year to make a living than Carrot Top, who has, you know, a multi-million dollar contract and has very little really to say to the world.
I agree with you 100%, Dylan. I have the same issues. You know, I wouldn't say that my comedy is anything like yours, or I certainly don't have this sort of intelligence on stage that you have. But when I decided to do stand up, I wanted to talk the way that I talked when I was a kid, and everybody thought that. You know, I grew up in a very low-class place, New Jersey, you know, and I grew up in West Orange, New Jersey. And I'm not saying West Orange is a low-class place, but my family were low-class Italian people. Like, I didn't come from high-class people. And the way I looked at it at the time, my mother died very young. She worked like a pig, and she died very young. And my mother was, like, one of the greatest people I ever met, but she had nothing, never had anything. The only house she ever owned was 5 years before she died. I bought her the only house she ever owned. So this woman never had a thing. When we were kids, we moved every 6 months. We were like nomads. And but I respected her. She never took anything. She helped whoever she could help. She was a great cook. And so even though she never had money, she cooked every night. The woman was kind of like, you know, she was like, for such a dichotomy. Yeah. She was like unbelievable. So, you know, but the word, like, she'd wake up in the morning. You didn't know if she was going to say good morning or she was going to tell you to go fuck yourself. Like, that's just the way it was. And you know, I can't say I was an abused child, but, you know, in today's world, they would have arrested her every day. But she taught me, but she taught me not to steal. She taught me to work hard, and she taught me some great things, right? So, I looked at it. Now, I wound up living in Jacksonville, Florida. Now, I have nothing bad to say about the people here. I live here. I live amongst these people. But the truth of the matter is they'll sit in church all day on Sunday, some of them, not everybody. I don't like to generalize anywhere. But some of them, they'll sit in church all day Sunday, and they'll, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am, and they'll run you into a fucking tree rather than tap on the brake and let you on the highway. And it makes me nuts. And they'll think that I'm like a piece of shit because the word fuck might come out of my mouth. And so I started doing stand-up down here, and I made everybody laugh. And these younger guys that were doing it were all like, well, it's because you curse and this and that and the other. You're a piece of shit and you're ruining comedy and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, fuck you, you know? And I got this really bad attitude about it, and I was like, you know, I'm gonna say whatever the fuck I want on stage. And when somebody pays me a lot of fucking money, like if they want to put me on NBC or something, I'll clean it up then. So I have the same issue. Like, people are telling me to be clean. I'm like, fuck you, pay me and I'll be clean. So, you know, and I face that all the time. You know, it's my art. I'll say what I want. If you know what? So and the reason I. And you know who helped me a lot with that was Bill Kinison. Bill Kinison came on the show once, and he told me that if Sam were still alive, that Sam and I would be best friends. He said, you're the exact kind of guy Sam would love. And I thought that was awesome because, you know, I identify a lot with Sam. I'm a big guy, was married 3 times. I told him I would never compare my talent with Sam. Sam was a phenomenon. But he said, you know what, I've seen some of your stuff. because I sent Bill a tape. And he said, I thought you were really funny. And I said, wow. And he goes, all those guys that hated you when you started, they all hated Sam when he started. Sam was one of the biggest comedians that ever lived. And if you talk to the people when Sam started, they'll all still tell you what a dirtbag Sam was and how they hate his guts. So what's that tell you? They were just jealous. And I can't tell you, Dylan, how much that helped me. So
it doesn't. If you want to get into my thoughts on Sam Kinison, I'm happy to have that conversation as well. But in terms of advice for you, there's some things I have to say. There's a danger with cursing a lot on stage. When I cursed all the time when I was a political comic, I cursed all the time. When I came back, when I had been doing storytelling on the radio and was going to start performing, I went out to clubs and started adding fuck to them, to the stories, just to keep people's interest, and then hated that and found other audiences. The danger with the vulgarity is that it can keep people laughing when you're not fully writing realized jokes. And I think for a lot of comics, I haven't seen your work, so I don't know that this is the case with you, but for a lot of comics, it becomes sort of an easy way of keeping the audience engaged and laughing rather than doing the hard work of refining the jokes to their highest potential. So I would urge you, and I'm not saying you should quit cursing, because, you know, use whatever fucking language you want. I don't care.
Right.
But once every now and then, make yourself do a clean set just to make sure all the jokes are as strong as they can be. And when you find there are lapses where you're not getting laughs, where you're used to getting laughs, figure out if that's because you've been using the language to substitute for actual joke dynamic.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I don't mean to cut you off.
It's the actual structure of a joke is what allows you to get the large money from the networks to go on television and do a clean set. If the 6 minutes doesn't work without the word fuck in it, you can't get it on TV either way.
Right. No, I believe you. And I will tell you that over the last few years, my attitude has certainly calmed down a little bit. And we were talking about Gladys Simon before, and I would perform at her shows at the Comic Strip Live, and I'd come off the stage and she would go, oh my God, you're so funny. Can we just be a little cleaner next week? And she was the first person who would ask me to work clean that I wouldn't get mad, because she was so sweet. And she was such a sweetheart that I would go, okay, Gladys, because I didn't take her the wrong way. And so one week I did do completely clean set for Gladys, because she said she had somebody there for TV commercials and she wanted me not to curse, so I didn't curse at all. And it was actually very funny, Dylan. I did my complete set with no cursing for Gladys. And then at the end of the set, I went, how did everybody like that? I didn't curse at all. Was everybody okay with that? And everybody clapped, and I went, oh, you know why I did that? That was for Gladys. You see Gladys over there? That's the queen of New York comedy. And then I just shredded her to pieces for about 8 minutes, about with a little horse. So anyway, I got it out that way. But no, honestly, you're right, Dylan, and people are right. And people are right that you can't get on. Matter of fact, Richie Tinkin, who owns the Comic Strip Live, I had to talk with him about it. And he said, yeah, you got to be clean. I said, Richie, weren't you Eddie Murphy's manager in the 80s? Like, he goes, yeah, you're not a skinny black kid. So you got to be clean.
There is that. And here's the thing. I haven't seen your work, so I don't know what your take is. When I was doing the comedy that I was doing as a left-leaning political comic, and I guess we are going to get into Sam a little bit here, I was sort of at the outer edge of Sam's entourage. I spent a bunch of evenings at his house up in the Hollywood Hills doing blow with him and Cara Loeve and Alan Steven and the crowd, and arguing with Sam because I hated Sam's politics. His ability to write great material was not enough for me to overcome how deeply I disagreed with what he was saying through his material. Because at heart, he was a Southern Baptist evangelical. So at that time, there were three guys that I sort of put into a category together. Kinison, Clay, and Tim Allen. They were all doing incredibly reactionary right-wing stand-up comedy and creating the illusion that they were cutting-edge liberals. In the case of Kinison and Clay, they were doing it by cursing a lot, which through the 60s and 70s had been the realm of Carlin and before that Lenny Bruce and the cutting-edge comics of the liberal era. And Tim Allen did it by bemoaning political correctness and then presenting these ideas of gender normative roles, that men are grunting pig beasts and women are shrill nags, which is why he then got those two TV series about how misogyny is never funny. That's not how they were pitched. That's just my interpretation. And Sam, while he was writing these great jokes, his jokes were ultimately about the idea that that it's okay to batter women, that anger and rage should be celebrated, not examined and overcome, that the poor can be blamed for their own poverty. It was just all these very right-wing reactionary ideas behind his work. And Andrew Dice Clay was doing sheer vulgarity and horrible misogyny, and all while they were creating this illusion that they were somehow rebelling. I was on the road doing left-leaning comedy and had to be louder and dirtier and sort of more grotesque than any of them were just to keep an audience engaged. And at the same time, I was making sure that I was writing really powerful jokes to back up my ideas. Now, I believe Sam was genuinely an artist. He had a worldview that he was expressing through brilliantly constructed material. I just disagreed with it. And the world has changed since 1985. And the fact is that cursing is no longer shocking. It no longer is a mark of originality that one can get on stage and fearlessly say these things that now get said on network television from time to time and constantly on HBO. Because HBO, in their first couple of years when they were doing comedy specials, they were literally telling people to say fuck more. Because the selling point on HBO was that it was the place where people could hear fuck. So now that's just become sort of another aspect of mainstream entertainment. And I think you will find yourself better served if you hone in more and more on what it is that you want to say through your jokes, how it is that you want to shape the zeitgeist and change the world, than on what words you use or don't use, because that's what's being watched by old-timey folk like me. And you are young enough to be ahead of the game on this and to be really thinking about what is the next thing that's going to shock people to realize there are people thinking and saying aloud, and it's going to be something other than dirty words.
Well, no, I hear you 100%, Dylan. You know, I'm not young, by the way. I'm 51. But I will tell you that I think I didn't get
you're younger than I am, kid. You're younger than I am.
I will tell you, when I first saw Sam, I see that shows you how smart you are. Because, I mean, now that you verbalize all this stuff about Sam, I can see it in hindsight because I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's been a long time since Sam's been on stage, but of course, I can kind of remember a lot of his bits. But I never really saw politics when I saw Sam. I saw a lot of hurt. I saw Sam in agony.
Yeah.
I saw Sam hurt over his failed marriages. I saw Sam hurt over the way he looked. I saw Sam hurt over being lonely, over, you know, the shit that he went through before he made it. You knew that this guy had pain in his life. You know what I mean?
And absolutely.
Then, And then you knew that the guy made it all. Like, that's where I identified with Sam Kinison. And so, and that's when I told Bill that I really identified with him. And so, and that's what I identified with. But, you know, now I see what you're saying. And, you know, okay. But, and that's where your intelligence comes in, because you were seeing politics and stuff. And I never even thought any of that. And all the years that I thought about Sam Kinison, I mean, I never, the word politics never even entered my brain when it, when
most
I thought
people
of
don't.
Sam Kinison. Yeah.
And that's, by the way, that is the beauty of stand-up comedy as an art.
Yeah.
Because we come in under the radar. People hear somebody doing an hour of funny, and they're laughing every 15 seconds for an hour. And whatever the political message is, if the comic is doing it without it being a screed, their minds can be changed. I'll tell you a story. When I was on the road as a comic doing my left-leaning material, and it was, you know, I structured my act very similarly in some ways to the way Sam did his. It was a lot about how wronged I felt and how angry I was at the world, but it was the anger of a skinny liberal, not the anger of an overweight, middle-aged former evangelist. It was a different anger, but it was the same sort of – I was pacing the stage and working up. Each topic became a rant. And this was at a time when a lot of people, Sam included, Clay included, a lot of people were doing material about fags. It was, and I had about 12 minutes on how homophobia was the last accepted form of bigotry in America at the time. So I was directly challenging ideas that had, that were mainstream comedy ideas, right? A lot of people were doing, you know, sure, the AIDS are, the gays are getting AIDS. You got to expect to pick something up when you're putting stuff up your ass. There's a lot of that kind of just gay hating, blame them for their own disease kind of material out there. And I was doing the opposite end of it. I was doing, we have to recognize bigotry where we see it, even when it's socially accepted. And I had a joke that I sort of built to that would get an applause break. And it would, if I was featuring, it would make it impossible for the headliner to get any laughs with the homophobic material. And once I was headlining, it was blowing the roof off the room, because I was able to take it up as though it was in response to whatever bullshit the feature act had just done about it. I mean, it was that common that people were doing gay bashing on stage, that I could go into my piece going, that guy was just talking about it, and here's what I think, and suddenly it was as though I had just thought of it, because an audience will take any excuse to suspend their disbelief and think that you're just talking off the cuff. And it built to a joke that I loved. This is when the biggest, most topical issue was gays in the military. And they keep saying, we can't let gays in the military. If we let gays in the military, it'll hurt morale. No, it won't. Look, you find yourself in the hills of Afghanistan under heavy fire. Don't you think the guy next to you is more likely to save your life if he's in love with you? See, I don't care what he thinks he's saving my ass for. As long as my ass is getting saved, my life is on the line. I want to be the most popular guy in the barracks. I'm buying candy and flowers for everybody.
That's funny.
And
well,
because the joke was structured right, people who would be perfectly willing to go with gay bashing would leave the room when I performed thinking about it differently, and never thought I was a political comic.
Yeah. No, that's a good joke. That's a, and you're right. You know,
yeah.
And see, I do a lot of stuff like that too, but I do stuff like trying to get people to like my whole thing politically, I mean, Dylan, is trying to get people to meet in the middle. Like, my whole thing is that you're not going to – look, we're not getting rid of each other. The people on the left are not getting rid of the people on the right. The people on the right are not getting rid of the people on the left. the black people are not getting rid of the white people, and the white people are not getting rid of the black people. So everybody needs to shut the fuck up. You know, we all need to get together and just get through all this shit. And I firmly believe that the answers are in the middle. I firmly believe that. You know, there's no, you know, and everything has gotten so out of line. Now, I mean, it's just gotten so vicious. When I was a kid, you know, Jimmy Carter was the first president I really remember. I remember Nixon was president when I was really young because I remember hearing things on the radio about Watergate in my ear. But I don't really remember Nixon's face in my head. But I remember just hearing things on the radio. But the first president I really remember on TV was Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter, of course, was a very liberal president. And I remember when he lost the election to Ronald Reagan, I cried because I felt so bad that our president lost at something. You know, and so when I was a kid, it didn't matter who the president was. You loved the president. It didn't matter. If there was a D or if there was an R, he was the president of the United States. You just loved the president. It is not that way in this country now. Whoever's the president, half the country literally hates the president now. They hated Barack Obama if they were Republican, and they hate Donald Trump right now if they're Democrat. This is not right. This has to end in this country. And I'm not saying that you got to love Trump. I'm not saying that you should have loved Obama. But you can't hate the president of the United States. This is
only
America.
Oh, yeah, I can. Oh, yeah, I can.
I know you do. I know all you guys do. I know you do. But listen, it's got to stop eventually, okay?
I feel I am entitled to hate anybody who cannot come out and say Nazis are bad.
Listen.
I'm pretty sure I'm allowed to hate those people.
Especially
on the New Year.
And I understand, but I think that there's got to become a point in time where we all have to face the facts that, like, every election, you're not going to get exactly who you want to win. So you have to say, okay, good luck, do a good job. You know, when Barack Obama won, I was down here. Now it's very prejudiced down here, I have to tell you. It's a very prejudiced where I live in Jacksonville, Florida, okay? Not everybody, but it's a very prejudiced place. So I was in the granite countertop business, and the shop next door to me, I could say because the guy's not there anymore, so nobody's going to find him. But the guy next door to me, him and two of his friends were sitting in their shop with shotguns in hand, out of their minds because Barack Obama won. And I went next door. I go, what are you doing? I go, what are you people doing? I go, listen, all you can do is hope that the man falls to his knees and says, oh, my God, I can't believe I actually won, because that's what I would do if I was ever elected president. I can't believe I actually won. And all you can do is hope that he realizes he's everyone's president, not just the people who want him to be president, but everyone's president, and hope he does a good job for everybody. Now, and you have to say, now, the whole 8 years that Barack Obama was president, I was, you know, in this business. I never once would say a bad word about President Obama. I always called him President Obama. When people talk viciously about him, I even defended him. That's the president of the United States. When people talk horribly about his daughters, I even put posts on Facebook, which I have a substantial following on Facebook. I would say people are ridiculous. These girls are beautiful girls. And so I think that we all need to get in the middle. The only reason that I would say that I think a little bit more conservatively than I do looking toward the left has nothing to do with what you think. Gay marriage I have no problem with. I have many gay friends. I love them very dearly. So I have no problem with gay marriage. I never did. I have no problem with gays in the military at all for not only the reasons you're saying. So none of this bullshit that these right-wing people, I think the fanatics on the right wing have to go. Completely, all that religious bullshit's got to go. And I think the left wing, the people that are crazy, crazy on the left have to go. They're both equally whacked out. They're both ruining this country. I honestly believe the answers are in the middle. For me, a guy with no higher education, I couldn't afford to go to college. I couldn't go to college. I always had to work with my hands, Dylan. I always had to make a living. And so for me, over the years, I started my first business when I was 23. I've seen when there's like Ronald Reagan, I made a lot of fucking money. Now, people that are smarter than me could say, well, he was stealing, he was this, that, he was doing that. You know what? For me, I think that there's that conservative people, conservative governments have ideas about making money that seem to work better. That's the only reason I think more along conservative lines. I think all the other bullshit has to go. I don't believe in telling a woman she can't have an abortion. I think that's ridiculous. I don't care if you have an abortion. It's none of my business. I think it's something that has to get out of politics. It was decided in the courts. So all of the things that really bother liberals, I agree with. I don't see why we fight over it in this country. So I'm not what you think. I'm not a right winger. I'm not at all.
I have no idea. I don't think anything about you. This is the first time I found out you were conservative.
No. A lot of people think like, oh, if you didn't vote for, you know, Hillary, then you automatically hate gays and you're. That's not true. For me, it's all economics. It's all like, you know, I like to make money, and I've always made more money when conservatives were in control. Now, there's a lot of people who don't feel that way, and I think that you have your right to feel however you want. But I do want people I don't want people like those idiots that were running around with shotguns because a black man was elected president. I don't want that. I don't want that. And I don't want people to burn buildings down because Trump was elected president. Now, when you were saying that Trump won't say bad things about Nazis, I don't really even know the entire story. Maybe that's true. And he should say there is no room for Nazis in America. That is absolutely true. I can't believe that he wouldn't say that because his daughter's a Jew. But, okay, that said and done, of course he should say that. But they started burning shit down the day after he was elected. So, you know.
No, we didn't. We did not burn anything down.
Okay. So let's say this. What I'm saying is, let's say we have to hate Trump during this entire presidency. And he's got to go, and okay, that's never going to stop. Can we say the next president we could stop? Like this has to stop.
Well,
sometime.
No, not anymore. Because here's the thing, and this is simply the nature of where America is right now, man. And first of all, be aware that you say that you were only aware of this kind of polarization politically since Obama. Or so, but the fact is, I was aware of it from Nixon. I was very young during Nixon, but I was the only kid in the grade school that I went to who, in our mock election between Nixon and McGovern, voted McGovern, and as a result of it, I was beaten up in the schoolyard.
Oh my God!
Because that meant that I was a hippie, and worthy of being beaten. I was very upset when Reagan was elected. Not because we're supposed to love our president, but because I knew that he was the guy who had cooperated with the House Un-American Activities Committee when he was the president of SAG. They had come to him and said, do you know of any SAG members who might be members of the Communist Party? And instead of saying, what are you, crazy? There's a matter of privacy in this, and besides, that's not how it works in America. He said, let me get a pen, I'll write a list. So I was very upset at the idea of having this collaborator with the evil bastards in the office. And then later I was upset, you know, because I wasn't sure he realized he was actually president. Now, the real polarization nationwide that went beyond those who were really politically savvy and politically aware happened under Bill Clinton. And it started when the right wing said, we are more interested in gaining and retaining power than we are in doing what's right for the country. And they began to vilify people on the left. Bill Clinton at the front of it, but everybody all the way down the line. they found every way they could to smear. And within two election cycles, the left had said, Jesus, the negative campaigning is actually getting the votes. We have to start doing it too. So because we live in a 24-hour news cycle, entertainment-addicted nation, people are constantly watching the thing that triggers the pleasant hormones. The joy of rage has taken over. And what we have is no longer a democracy. What we have is now this weird mentalist's trick where half the country is told to hate the king of spades and the king of clubs, and the other half is told to hate the king of diamonds and the king of hearts. And then eventually it gets down to just the king of hearts against the king of clubs. And then we're told to hate the other one, and then we all vote for our king. And then for 4 years, everybody says, oh, I hate the king of clubs, or, oh, I hate the king of hearts. And nobody stops to think that maybe we should have evolved beyond the point where we have a fucking king.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's all fucked up. It's completely fucked up. Yeah.
So that's my cheerful note for today.
I'll tell you what, you have some incredible insight, brother. I knew you were a bright guy just from watching some of your stuff and talking to you. I just want to digress one more time.
Anything you like. Digression is my line of work.
Yeah, because you said you hung out with Sam and you argued politics and you were in his house in Hollywood Hills. What would he say when you would hit him with this stuff? Was he?
Shut up. Who's paying for the blow? Mostly he would also say, sit down and roll up a dollar. Nobody leaves till all the blow is gone. I'm the party goalie. He mostly just yelled. He got louder. The more he was challenged, the louder he got. And sometimes the funnier he got, which was difficult for me because I'm used to being the funniest person in the room. But as soon as he was challenged, he would start snapping off jokes that would wind up in his act. And that wasn't just me. That was everybody. He would say, and you could see it in his eyes when he had found something he was going to be able to use later. It was genuinely why do you feel, what are you, a fag? You need to defend them? Come on. They got such a big problem with me, let them defend themselves. There was a lot of that. And there was, you know, if what they're doing isn't wrong, why do they have AIDS? There was a lot of that nonsense, you know. Because there were talking points floating on the right at that time as much as there were on the left. And he was hearing all of them, probably from his family, who were all, you know, still Southern Baptists.
Yeah, Bill's a preacher again. Bill's running the church.
Very bad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's in their blood. I mean, that's what he feels is the right thing to do. Listen.
I am so thoroughly an atheist that when people tell me they believe in God, I don't believe them.
Well, listen, I've learned, in a little tiny bit of the show business thing that I have going on, Dylan, which I'm like dripping off the bottom rung of the show business ladder. Like I don't claim to have any career at all, but
aren't
just the little tiny bit that I've been exposed to and the few people I've gotten to talk to, which has been kind of cool. I realize that there's so many different people in this world. And my job is to like, to take in what I hear, and to love everybody unless they give me a very good reason not to. And so I have
damn
an
atheist fine
friend.
Way to approach it. A damn fine way to approach it.
Yeah, and I really do. And so, you know, I can't expect everybody to be like me. I can't expect everybody to believe what I believe. And I don't. And I find people, and I love people for who they are, unless they're vicious or evil, and unless they want to hurt other people. And so, you know, if an intelligent guy like you who's out there and you think different politically and you don't believe in God, you know, good for you. And, you know, maybe you're going to teach me something someday. I'm never going to say, you know, anything bad about you. I'm going to tell you this. It was a really extreme pleasure talking to you. I never know what I'm going to get when somebody calls into the show, but it was an extreme pleasure talking to you. Do you know we talked almost an hour, and so I think that's awesome.
It's been good talking to you, man. Thanks so much for having me on.
I learned a lot.
Hey, I'm going to tell you again that everybody, I want you guys to check out dylanbrody.com, dylanbrody.com, and get his book, The Modern Depression Guidebook, and Laughs Last. And they're available at his site, dylanbrody.com and amazon.com. You could also check out Dylan Brody on Facebook. Dylan, a distinct pleasure, my friend. I hope we talk again.
A joy to the lights here. Next time I'm on the East Coast, we'll work somewhere together.
I would really appreciate that, brother.
All right, man. Take care.
Hey, take it easy. Bye-bye. So that was kind of awesome, huh, Dwayne?
Yeah, that was. That was one of those times I had to sit back and be quiet and learn. I felt that.
Well, I mean, the man had a lot to say, and and we had to let him talk,
he's a mouthful. It went down in history. That's a good recording. He dropped a lot of jewels for up and coming comedians. If they have the knowledge to take that education that he dropped tonight, that's why he did it like that. You know. He wanted to have that recorded, you know. That was interesting.
He was extremely intelligent guy. I mean, if you don't agree with every single thing he says, the guy presents his arguments in a way where you got to say, yeah, well, okay. And so that was Dylan Brody, everybody.
Dylan Brody.
Hey, so you know, little brother, you co-host on a show where you really didn't get a chance to say too much. But I'm sorry about that. But you know, a lot of times we have somebody on where we could fuck around, we could blah 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 blah. But you know, the guy was just, I think I held my own with the guy, but
he really dropped Jewel. That was the most educational podcast that I had, you know what I mean? Went through it. I learned a lot. I learned not to book a show in Jackson, Florida, because I would bomb it.
No, you know what, dude? I mean, honestly, I never really knew prejudice till I came here, because I grew up in 9 miles west of Manhattan, dude. You know what I mean? So everybody's different up there. Everybody's from somewhere else. You know, New York City.
Melting pot, yeah.
But, you know, I came down here and they would even look at me like, you know, first of all, you're a Yankee. Now, it's gotten better since 2001, but, you know, you're a Yankee. And then second of all, you're an Italian Yankee. You know what I mean? Oh. Like, I opened up a $1 million granite shop down here. You know, and people come in, look me up and down, go, "You one of them Italian Yankees, ain't you?" I was like, "Oh my God!" I was like, "What the fuck?" I was like, "Yeah, come on in. I'm going to steal your money. Come on in." You know, like "Fuck." I'm in the mafia. Come in. It was just crazy. I had one guy call me a WAP. I go, "WAP? I haven't heard that one in fucking years. Where are you? Where the fuck are you getting this shit from?" So,
I was starting to are you gonna have a millennial hating turn?
Let me tell you something, Dwayne. Here's the truth about people being prejudiced and people not liking other people. This is true. People are prejudiced, and people don't like other people. And so here's what you have to do in life. You have to get over it. Who the fuck cares? I mean, we all have this thing where we think our shit's the best, right? Take for an example a simple fart. I read an article yesterday that farts are actually good for you. Do you know that everybody likes to smell their own farts? And there's a physiological there's a physiological reason for this, because farts are actually good for you. They actually help your body. There's things in your fart that your body needs. And so over time, nature makes you want to smell your own fart. You don't even know why you're smelling your own motherfucking farts. But
you
want to
see how you're doing.
Yeah, but you want to smell your own fart. You don't even know why. But it's because nature knows that you should smell your farts. Okay, so people even think their own, but you don't like other people's farts, right? So your friend will sit next to your fart. You'll be like, oh, you nasty motherfucker. So even when it comes to a simple fart, you think your own farts are the best, and somebody's fart, other farts are no good. So people think, like, where's your family from? I know you're a black dude, but where's your family from, the Caribbean?
Yeah, they're from Nevis, St. Kitts, Nevis.
Okay, so on a special holiday, what kind of food does your family cook?
Both. They, but mainly, you know, islands, West Indian dishes.
Okay, so tell me, what's a West Indian dish? Like, say it's Christmas, what's your family from the islands, what's their big dish? What's the best thing to eat?
I would say curry chicken.
Okay, so you probably think this curry chicken is like the shit, dude. You're like, fuck, I want this curry chicken, right? It's Christmas, I want my curry chicken. But, you know, to an Italian family, they're like, curry chicken? Fuck you.
Mm-hmm.
I want my motherfucking lasagna. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean nothing. They just think that their shit's the best. So you know, Irish people make corned beef and cabbage. I fucking, you know, I want lasagna. It doesn't mean that I don't fucking like you. It just means I think my shit's the best. Who cares?
I know
what I mean? Gives a fuck. Go have your curry chicken. But here's the way we are in this world. Here's the way we are in this world. You want, not you, but a lot of people. Oh, you don't think my curry chicken's the best? You're a racist. No, fuck yourself. Go have your curry chicken and fuck yourself. You understand what I'm saying? I'm going to go have my fucking lasagna over here, and I'm going to fuck myself. And then you fuck yourself over there, I'm fucking myself over here. And why don't we all fuck ourselves and shut the fuck up? Like, this is what we all have to do in this country. Now, there was a time, and so, see, we're all overcompensating. So there was a time when people were treated very harshly because of who they were. And so black people were treated very poorly. Obviously, they were slaves. Now, but what black people are failing to do, okay, is forgive. Now, you could say, well, it's easy for you to say forgive. What do you have to forgive anybody about? Well, let me tell you something. I'm not black. I can never know what it was like to be a slave. And I could say that I'm sure it was quite horrible. And if I owned any slaves, I promise you I would get on my hands and knees and beg forgiveness. Because... No, I honestly would, because I could never treat a human being like that. I mean, to watch it in a movie makes me sick.
You'd have paid your slaves. You'd have paid your slaves.
No, and not only that, I would never beat an innocent girl. I would never fucking do that. Like, I watch some of the movies, dude, especially some of the new ones, and they just make me sick. You know what I mean? And so, yes, horrifying. The problem is that what people don't understand is that slavery happened all over the planet, not just in America. Okay? And slavery happened in every culture for thousands of years. Okay? And so, you know, we think that America was this evil place because of slavery. But then if America was evil, the whole planet was fucking evil. Not just America. Yeah. And then there came a time when people in America started to say, wait a minute, this slavery is not the right thing. We need to end it. And there were some very greedy people that didn't want it to end because they were getting free labor. And that's how they were making money. And they said, no, let's not end this. And But there were enough people who said, no, this isn't right. We need to end it. And so there, a lot of stuff was changed in the history books to make it look like there were a lot of other reasons for the Civil War. But if you really cut through the bullshit, the main reason for the Civil War was to end slavery. So so let's say that 600,000 Americans died to end slavery. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a lot of penance right there, wouldn't you say? So, okay. Now, let's say still there was a lot of bad behavior toward black people. And one of my heroes in this life is Dr. Martin Luther King. I go to a place very often called St. Augustine, Florida, and I love it. I walk there a lot. I go down there a lot. I have very good friends that own a deli there called Drake's Deli. I go there often. And I was shocked and amazed to find a little storefront where Dr. Martin Luther King was actually arrested one time for sitting at the counter and trying to get something to eat. And and I was amazed, awe that I felt to be standing somewhere where this man actually was.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that when I got a Johnny Rocket.
Why do you feel like that, Johnny Rocket? Why do you feel like that, Johnny Rocket?
Because it's like 1950s set in this.
You're fucked up.
I swear to God, I do. I'm like,
honestly, Dr. Martin Luther King was in this building, dude. You know what I mean? Like, that's like fucking crazy. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was stunned to read the plaque. And, wait a minute. Go ahead. Tell your little.
I was just telling my girlfriend about the cotton plant itself, how it was more thornier than a rose bush. How, you know what I mean, just to be in that field, you would have 1,000 cuts and infections and sticky. It's so hard. It's almost like an armadillo skin where you have to crack it open very thin. It's so painful. You know
what
I mean? These are the things that,
dude, it's
that people
it's
gotta go through. Yeah.
But Dr. Martin Luther King, dude, he changed the planet. And this is why he's a hero of mine. Not only did he really change the shit, but he did it without being violent. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. And that's why he changed it. I'm going to tell you why. When you get violent, okay, and you think that's the only way you can get people to listen, you lose. Because I don't give a fuck what you're fighting for. When you hurt people, you lose people. Because now people don't listen to your story. They just don't like you. And Dr. Martin Luther King was smart enough to know, if I get nasty and vicious and violent, nobody's going to listen to me. And the man spoke.
Got smoked.
He spoke. He smoked. Unfortunately, it was one of the most horrible things that ever happened. But if you think about it, I think God does everything for a reason. And God made, in the Catholic religion, we call some of our saints martyrs. They were killed and then I'm a saint, and Dr. Martin Luther King's like a saint, you know, he was like a martyr, you know what I mean? So, but here's the thing, he kept himself, you know, from getting violent, and that's why this man won. Besides, he was brilliant and he knew what to say and when to say it, and his charisma, but he never got violent, dude. And as a matter of fact, he told people not to get violent, and that's why he won, dude. He won. Now, I honestly believe, as evidenced by the fact that Barack Obama was president of the United States for 8 years, that a black man could do anything he wants in our great country. And so it's time to get over all of this shit. Am I saying to you out there, am I saying anybody's going to hand you anything? No. But I'm going to tell you something right now. My family are Italian people. And when we came here, which was after slavery, by the way, so nobody in my line ever owned a slave, could never have done it. We weren't here when the shit was going on. We were in fucking Italy. But my family came here, and when Italians got here, we were treated like pigs, like pigs. Remember that word I said somebody called me down here, WAP? But that meant without papers. When we got here, we were treated like fucking animals. The reason that the mafia got such a stronghold in this country was because Italians were so poorly treated in New York City, and they couldn't even go to the police. They had to make up their own little fucking people to protect them. These were the original mafia bosses. Okay? So, okay.
So they like the Crips and Bloods.
Exactly. So when you're I would say it's a little tiny bit different, but when your great great grandfather was the guinea rag picker that went down the street picking up trash, and he was a guinea rag picker and he was a piece of shit, that was fine. But when he did that and then years later it became worth some money, and then you went and said, hey, get out of here, guinea rag picker. I'm gonna do this now and I'm gonna make the money. And then he went, well, I didn't know, that's not fair. And then he went to the local Don, and Don said, okay, I'll be partners with you. That's all of a sudden why all the mafia guys owned all the garbage trucks in New York City for 40 years. Because that's how it happened. You know what I mean? Then it got a little nasty. Then it got like where if you bought a garbage truck without the right guy's permission, you got shot in the face. I mean, that was going a little overboard. But that's how all this shit happened, because the Italians were treated like pigs. What I'm telling you is every race of people that came here had to go through their shit. Everybody. Every culture that comes to America has to go through shit. Not as bad as slavery. No. I'm not saying
that. Can't have our top oppression spot. No.
No, 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 no. And I don't want it. I'm not saying that African Americans don't have the right to grieve, and I'm not saying that African Americans don't have a right to feel pain over what happened. But
yeah,
but you know, for everybody's good, it's, you know, you got to move on, and for your own good, because I'm going to tell you right now, dude, nobody's going to come by and hand you shit.
Yeah.
So the only way to get out of shit is to do nothing. I'm going to tell you right now, nothing fucking kicks somebody in the face better than you making it.
Yeah.
You want to fucking make, you want to piss people off, dude, make it. You want people to go, you motherfucker, make it. And I don't mean make it big in show business. I don't mean make it. I mean, just be successful.
Mm-hmm.
You want somebody to go, look at that fucking black motherfucker. In their fucking under their breath, you drive down the street in a nice car with nice clothes, and then and you got people going, hey, mother, and you know what? Good for them, because that's what you got to do. You got to make it, and the only way you're gonna make it, dude, is you got to stop worrying about who did this and who did that and who ain't this, and go get your own shit. So that's my little fucking history lesson for today. And I'm gonna tell you, dude, I was in the hood yesterday. I don't know if you saw my two videos on Facebook.
Yeah.
Some little dude walks up to me and goes, man, I'm so hungry, sir. Can you give me some money? And I don't give money away anymore, but I used to all the time. But I don't anymore, right? This guy just fucking got me. I don't know how he did it. I looked at his eyes, and they looked really white, like he wasn't a drinker. So I go, do you drink, dude, or are you going to use this money for fucking alcohol? He goes, no, sir, I don't drink. I go, are you kidding me? You don't drink? He goes, no. And so another dude was walking by. Now I'm in the fucking hood, dude. I'm all by myself in the hood getting gas. Because I'm going to tell you right now, here's how I am. The fucking gas light goes on in my car. And, you know, I could have got out of the hood before I got gas. I could have drove another 30 miles with the gas light on. But, you know, I don't like to be like that. I'm like, you know what? I'm in the hood. I'll get gas in the hood. So what? I'm not like that, you know. So I get out of the car in the fucking hood to get gas, and a guy comes up to me, you know, I'm hungry. I go, all right, motherfucker, you sure you ain't going to drink? He goes, no. So another dude was walking by, I go, oh, yo, you know this dude? He goes, what about him? I go, does he drink? He goes, no, man, he don't drink. I go, all right. I peeled off a $10 bill and handed it to the dude. Because what are you going to buy with $2 nowadays, you know? So I handed him a $10 bill, and motherfucker didn't even say thank you, which bothered me. He said thank you. But they walked to the stop sign, and I got a video of this on fucking Facebook. Right? He walked to the stop sign, and the two dudes bumped fists, and they walk right across the street into the liquor store. Dude, I got so fucking pissed off. And I'm like motherfucking them. And I'm still in the fucking hood by myself with a bunch of fucking dudes all around me that could have kicked my ass. But I'm like, you motherfucker. So I get my phone out. I start videotape telling the story. And I'm like, I'm going to sit here and wait for these motherfuckers to come out of the fucking liquor store. And I'm going to fuck this guy up for taking my $10 and walking to the liquor store. And what do you think happened? As soon as I stopped making that video, I'm not lying to you. A fucking beautiful black girl. I mean, she's beautiful. Walks over to the car and asks me for money. I go, baby, you're beautiful. She goes, she goes, really, really sweet. The girls down here, you know, they have southern accents, and if you remember that show on TV, I forget what it was called, but the girl had a southern accent. She was really cute, but they sound like her, you know. So she goes, I know people tell me I'm beautiful, but think it's so easy, but I'm homeless. And I said, oh my God. I said, you know what, baby, I'm not even going to ask you if you drink. Here's $5. She's here. And she just turned around and walked away. She didn't go in a liquor store. She went right across the street. There's an apartment building. And she started yelling at these guys in the stairway. And so I started my car and I pull into the parking lot. I wanted to see who she was yelling at. And there's three big fucking dudes, dude, with dreads and everything. So I know what they are.
They're little Haiti.
Yeah, dude. And there's three of them big dudes. And I look at her and I go, baby, can I ask you a question? I go, right before you asked me for money, another dude asked me for money. I go, what's going on around here? There's no jobs. I go,
You ain't selling drugs?
And I thought I was recording and I was going to ask her if I could put the video on Facebook. But turns out I didn't hit the record button right. But I said, and she was really sweet kid. I said, baby, I said, let me ask you a question. I said, right before you asked me for money, another dude asked me for money. What's going on right here? There's no jobs. I mean, is it the economy still bad? Is it that people are really prejudiced because they won't give black people jobs? I go, I'm very curious. I go, seriously, because I hate to see a person like you suffer. And I was being serious, dude. It broke my heart that kid, beautiful girl like her, has got to walk up to people she doesn't even know and ask for money and say she's homeless. Because
don't
to
come
me,
to my house. They'll break your heart over here.
Well, seriously. So she looked at
That's
me.
That's crazy.
Dude, without even batting an eyelash, you know what she said to me?
Yeah.
She goes, no, it's crack. Everybody around here is on crack. Now, I didn't even know crack was still a fucking thing. Crack's still a thing.
I know. Yeah, I don't like the young crackheads. I can't do that. I'd be like, you didn't see not one Spike Lee movie? How did this happen?
Yeah,
it's
so
good as the designer. They got designer drugs out now. You take it and wake up the next day and go right to work like nothing happened. And then, but they going to go to crack that kills. Crack kills. Remember, golly, I can't stand that. That's an epidemic of 18-year-old crackheads. Yes, go ahead.
She said everybody over there is on crack. And I said to her, I said, sweetheart, I said, don't you have people that love you? I go, you know.
Yeah, looking for.
I said, honestly, baby. I said, I don't know what to say to you. Now, the three dudes are, like, starting to yell shit at me. And I'm just like, shut the fuck up. You know what I mean? But, because, dude, you don't know me. I'll get out of the car. Like, I'm a fucking idiot when I get mad. You know what I mean? And I'll probably get shot or whatever. I don't give a fuck. I'm pretty drunk. I don't give a fuck. So,
and over a $2 drug deal?
No.
Don't do that.
Dude, I ain't even trying to buy drugs. I don't do no drugs ever. Like, I'm very
I know. It's just the area.
So wait. So I don't know if they thought I was bothering the girl or trying to fucking whatever. But I said to her, look, baby, don't you know people love you? I mean, can't you get some help? And she just looked at me and she went, thank you so much for the money, because I handed her a $5 bill. And I said, you know, baby, I don't know what to say to you. I said, I wish you, God bless you. I wish you a lot of luck. And I put my car in reverse and left. And I was driving away, and I said to myself, all I could do is not come back over here.
Yeah.
But all I thought about for the rest of the day, honestly, popped into my head about 15 times, is if I was Donald Trump, not the word Donald Trump, but if I was the president of the United States, how could I help these fucking people? How can anybody help these people?
Public school.
No. And then I even had a conversation with Mark Helfgott about it yesterday, because when I called him up on the phone, we were talking about the cartoon, and I said, how can people help these people? And he told me, because he's older than I am, you know, and he said, Mike, there's always a segment of the population, always, that lives this kind of life, and it's never going to stop. And all people do is do what you did, drive away. And I said, that's heartbreaking. So when I tell you, Dwayne, when you hear me say, you got, you know, not you, I'm not saying you or anybody in particular. I don't generalize, and I take everybody I meet as they come. But when I say people that are stuck in a situation where they're blaming people, or they're blaming the past, or they're blaming, and it doesn't have to be black people, doesn't have to be, it could be anybody. When I tell you, I care about every human being. When I see that girl, I never met her before. I just saw a sweet girl, and I felt bad for her all fucking day. Now, I'm not ashamed to. I got my own fucking life to live, and I've been in a bad situation for years now. I've been stuck here. I've been having to raise my kids. I didn't particularly want to be here. You know, I lost everything. I owned when the economy collapsed. Dude, my life, I am 51. I got to make something for myself. I'm not a fucking priest. You know, but the truth of the matter is, what can you do? But I could tell you this. If anybody will listen to anything I could say, all I could tell you people is just fucking get your shit together. Mm. Get up in the morning and try to fucking do something for yourself. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just take a fucking little step every day. Wake up. Yep. One from the other. You ain't fucking dead yet. You know what I mean? Like, look at my man, Dwayne. Works hard. That's what people say. Why do you like... Somebody asked me the other day why I liked you so much. You never even met the kid yet. I said, the fucking kid's out there working. He's a worker. He's a nice kid. He works.
Yeah.
He ain't afraid to fucking work. He says nice shit to people. He's got a good heart, I could tell. Dude, if everybody was like you, the world would be a better place. You know, I need friends like you.
I need
kids like you. I need young people like you to talk nice to people. I see you out there. You're putting shows together. You're trying to do shit for charity already. You know, you got a good heart. Look.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I'm not selfish.
Be like my little brother. And that's why I freely call you on Facebook my little brother all the time now. Because I see you got a good heart. And you got a good heart. And I wish you a lot of success. And I think you're a talented guy.
Thanks.
No, and I think you got I think your mind's in the right place. I think your heart's in the right place. I think you got some talent to you. And I think that, you know, as long as you keep that spirit, brother, good shit's going to happen to you. And
thanks.
And I'm going to tell you, I know a lot of fucking people. Not a lot of people have that. A lot of people are nasty, rotten fuckers. And, you know, you got to put up with them because you can't live by yourself on this planet. But it's good to know that he's a good kid. So what else you got to say, Dwayne? I talked enough.
I learned a lot. You know, and I appreciate the opportunity for getting on these podcasts. This was one of my first podcasts. I only did, but they were all with you. But you know what I mean? It's just the beginning of breaking into talk radio. You're doing extremely well in a lot of areas. The cartoon is phenomenal.
Thank you. Have you been watching them?
You know, your writing. I like to like learn from them.
I appreciate
it's collective.
I appreciate it. Well, I'm working on a screenplay now, and I had two screenplays completely done, and they were awesome. They were both looked at, ready to go. I ripped them both up because I'm a little nuts. One of them I ripped up because I thought, I'll tell you off the air sometime what it's about. But it's already been copyrighted, but I still don't want anybody to hear about it yet. But I have a very good friend and Hollywood producer that told me that it's an awesome idea and that it definitely needs to be sent back in. So I have to redo it. But it's no big deal. I know the story. It's just the fact that I have to sit here and type it again. And we're the dude we just had on, Dylan Brody, said he could do a screenplay in a week. That is not me.
I know, right? Now he's going to
type out a screenplay in a week. But I will have to redo it because I have someone who wants me to get the screenplay sold. And so, you know, but I am a busy guy, but bullshit to that, I got to get it done. So I do have that going on, the cartoon going on, you know, but we live in a world, dude, where I'm not making a lot of money with this shit yet. So I still have to work. So I am a realtor and that's very time consuming. So, you know, all I do is work, which is good. It keeps me out of trouble. But I am looking forward to coming back to New York soon. That's what I'm doing.
Definitely.
So when I do, we will definitely be hooking up a lot, me and your brother.
Yep, definitely.
All right. So I want to wish everybody, all my Jewish friends, a very happy new year.
Yeah, me too.
Marco, who passed out from eating too much food. A happy new year, that you old fucker that you are. He can't even go to temple without passing out anymore. So I don't know what we're going to do with his ass, but fuck him. But happy new year. And Dylan Brody was an awesome guest. So we really appreciate Dylan Brody. Please get at Dylan at his website, dylanbrody.com. Get his two books, Laughs Last and The Modern Depression Guidebook, at Amazon.com and DylanBrody.com. Little brother.
Yeah.
Thank you for helping me out tonight. Much appreciated.
It's my pleasure.
And we'll talk soon. Everybody, that was the Mike Boyle Show. We'll see you next week when our special guest will be Al Martin, owner of the world famous comedy clubs in New York City, and just an all around great guy. We're really very happy that he'll be coming on. And of course his comedy club was just named one of the top five clubs in New York. Did you hear that? The Broadway.
Yeah.
The Broadway.
Yeah, I think I was the man.
Yeah, it was named one of the top five clubs in New York. Of course it was. And he also owns the Greenwich Village Comedy Club. So he'll be on next week. I'm very excited to talk to him. And see you guys next week. Thank you, brother. Thanks, Wayne. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.